Good evening. My name is Bruce Angelet, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, it is good to be here tonight. It's kind of nice to come to this meeting, and I think I know more people at this meeting than any other people I go to, any other meeting I go to. And when I came in here tonight, I thought this was either an H&I meeting or a planning meeting for Southern California Convention. I wasn't quite sure. But it's good to have so many friends at Alcoholics Anonymous, to have made some friends, and to say that I have friends today, you know, and that I can show up today. And that's what this is all about. And I'd like to share with you a little bit about today, what it's like, what happened, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And my life is so good today, it frightens me at times. You know, and I can take no credit for it. I have to give all the credit to a God of my understanding that you have given to me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for the willingness to do everything that I swore I would never do. You know? And that's why I'm here today. It's a gift. And let me say before I forget that I believe that the only reason I have been given the gift of sobriety is because I'm here to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous in all of my affairs. And as long as I can remember that is my primary and my only purpose for being given the gift of sobriety, that I can go about my business. Because armed with that, then I can keep in mind that I'm about God's business, not Bruce's business, you know. I'm not my job, I'm not my marriage, I'm not my friends, I'm not my car. I'm about God's business. And as long as I can remember that, then I'm on the right place and I'm comfortable. And the reason I say that it's good because I'm comfortable, because for me, it's not so important, you know, what I drank or what we drank or where we drank it or how much of it, or whether we drank it out of a bottle under the sink like I did toward the end, or whether we shot it or what we did with it. I don't think that's so important. To me, what's really important is why I did what I did. And as I look back on it today, I didn't know it at the time. The reason that I did what I did was to get rid of those god-awful feelings that I had. You know, I had feelings that I couldn't stand long before I ever took my first drink of alcohol. Seems far back as I can recall, I had two sets of feelings. And these feelings kind of felt, I categorize them today, they kind of felt into two categories. Fell into two categories. You know, on the one hand, at one minute I could be, and as I seem to be most of the time, was I'm not good enough, I don't fit in, you don't really like me, my parents really didn't want me, the other kids didn't want me around, and all those feelings that add up to being I'm not good enough, I'm less than you, I'm less than everyone. But yet in the bat of an eye, I could have these feelings from this other category of, and they kind of categorized to me like, don't you know who I am? What do you mean I'm going to have to work at this? You know? What do you mean this is not going to come easy for me? You know, this I'm better than you are. Don't you know who I am? And I always had those feelings. It seemed like I was either in one group or the other, and they would come and go. You know, and the bottom line was that I was uncomfortable all of the time. You know? And I knew the problem was me. And as a result, I was confused all the time, I wanted to run all the time, I was full of fear all of the time. Now, of course, I didn't know that when I was growing up. I didn't learn that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I was so afraid, you know, and I wanted to run all the time. You know, and I was so uncomfortable that it was never okay where I was or when it was, you know. If it was now, it was always going to be better 5 minutes from now. Or next week, it's really going to be better. Or, gee, this summer, I'm going to get it together, and it's really going to be good this summer. It was never okay when it was. And it was never okay where I was. If I was over here, it would be better if I went over there. So I go over there, and then, no, it's going to be better over there. You know, and I was out of balance. I was just confused. You know, and when you know you're the problem, you don't have any option of going to your mother or father or saying, hey, I'm afraid. I'm confused. You know, I knew it was me. You know? And that's all I had to work with, was that I was the problem. Little did I know I was the problem, but not for the same kind of reason. And I had these feelings, and I was uncomfortable. You know, as I look back on it, I was searching for something to make me comfortable. Now, alcohol, I didn't hook up with alcohol for quite a while because my dad was an alcoholic. And for those of us that grew up in a home where alcohol is a problem, you know what I'm talking about, you know? And I had these feelings and I couldn't do anything about them, you know? And I was really confused because my dad confused me, because here was a guy who, when he was sober, was kind. He was nice to me. We did grow up in New Jersey, and that was back in the days when the Dodgers still played at Ebbets Field. And to show you how much I thought of myself, I couldn't root for the Yankees. See, I rooted for the Dodgers because they were perennial losers, right? But I was a big Dodger fan, and a big treat for me was my dad to take me into Ebbets Field. And he would take me there. He'd let me eat all the hot dogs I wanted. He would even take me to see a doubleheader, and we'd sit there and have a great time. And next thing I know, we're home. And the next thing I know, he's yelling and screaming and throwing things and running out the door and going to the tavern up the corner, you know. I couldn't figure out how come this guy that I loved so much, I could hate him so much and was full of fear about him, you know. I couldn't understand that. And I had a lot of anger toward him. In fact, it took me till I was 6 years sober to come to terms with the anger, because I would share it from a podium about my father and my feelings about him. You know, and the anger got so intense, it was as though he were in the room, or he was there, he was still drinking, you know. And all of a sudden, in talking with Lynn and with Milton, the light went on. And what finally happened, thank God to this program, and I was able to deal with it, was the fact that I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had gotten sober, I had forgiven myself for being an alcoholic, but you see, I had never forgiven him for being an alcoholic. And when I talked to him, that anger was still there. I was still angry with him. And when the realization came, I was able to deal with that anger and be able to forgive him and say, "Dad, I'm sorry. You know, you no more wanted to be an alcoholic than I did." You know, thank God that we have this program and that we can come to these realizations when it is time. You know, I wouldn't have known what to do with it earlier, but in God's time, I was able to deal with that. Because I had so much anger toward him, because I couldn't understand. You know, he'd be nice one minute, then next thing he'd be yelling and throwing things and all of that insanity. Or he'd be grabbing my brother by the hair and shoving food in his throat, or taking his plate and throwing it against the wall or in the sink or in the trash. And, you know, and I was so frustrated. It took me a long time to figure out what the problem was, because when I was a little kid, I couldn't know what it was. I didn't know. All I knew was my gut would wrench, and I would have this gut-wrenching fear, and all I would want to do was run, you know. And what I used to do is, at dinner time was the time, because see, I knew that that's when something was going to happen, because invariably that's when it did, you know, because that's when everybody was together, you know. So I would sit down and eat as fast as I could, you know, and dinner was one. You don't say anything at dinner time, you know, because you don't want to get him upset, or you don't want to say the wrong thing, because maybe what you're saying is going to trigger all of this insanity that's going to follow, or when it's going to come, you know. And it got so bad for me, and the fear was so great, that I would sit down at a dinner table, and I would actually get nosebleeds, and the blood would just gush out of my nose, because the fear was so great, you know. I mean, that's how alcohol affected me, and that's the environment that I lived in, and it kept me off balance. And it kept me frightened, and I spent a lot of time in myself, you know. So I didn't have any place to talk about my feelings. So as I look back on it, I was on this search for something to deal with it, something to make me comfortable, you know. And as I look back on it, I can remember my father, you know, because I can remember, like, on Saturday, he'd be there painting or fixing something around the house, you know. We always had to fix things. That was another one of those, "I am better. God, we deserved a better house than we had, or a better car." You know, all the other kids had new cars, and we always had fixer-upper cars, and he was always working on them and fixing around the house. But I can remember, he would work for a while, and then that uneasiness would set in, you know. And I would see him kind of getting a little bit restless, and he'd put the paintbrush down or whatever in the paint can, and I knew he was headed for the tavern up the corner, see. And I would say, "Well, come on, Dad, I'll help you and we'll finish it," because I didn't want him to go, you know, because I knew what would happen, and yet he would go, you know. So that's the way it was, you know, and so I had these feelings. I knew I wasn't good enough. I knew I didn't fit in, you know, and God gave me just enough intelligence to get by, and I'm grateful for that, you know. And as our first speaker said, I identify with him because I was a great starter, and I faded very fast also. You know, I could remember when the new year at school would come, I would get excited. Hey, school's coming, you know. And when I was a little kid, my mother used to get these little pencil boxes. Some of you might be old enough to remember those, with the little drawers on them, and you would have a pencil and an eraser and a protractor and maybe some crayons and a couple of brand new pencils in it, you know, and be hot shit ready to go to school, you know. And off I'd go to school, and yeah, it'd be great for a couple of days, and then the teacher would start laying homework and stuff on us, you know. And then that "you want me to do that" attitude would set in. "Don't you know who I am?" That was the kind of attitude I had. And I would lose interest real quick, you know. And, you know, that's the way it was for me. I would start fast, get some good grades at the beginning of the semester, you know, down the rat hole I would go. I remember algebra one year, I had A+ the first quarter, right? By the time the last quarter rolled around, I had C. Only because I didn't do it. I wouldn't do it, you know? What do you mean? You want me to have to do that? Don't you know who I am? I was looking for the easier, softer way even then, you know? As I look back on it, the easier, softer way, that's what I wanted. You know, and I didn't fit in anywhere. I knew the other kids didn't want me around. I was not very good about women, you know, and I just got by in life, you know? And I can remember some of those god-awful feelings, you know, that, now why don't I know how to, see, I figured that because I am, I would know how to handle situations, you know? See, I expected that I should know how to be able to talk with women, you know? Or be able to, what one would do on a date. Now, I would never ask anybody because it wasn't cool to ask anybody, you know? Because the guys all talk like, yeah, I know this, I know that. I didn't know that, see? And I didn't know that you could ask anybody. So I never asked, and I never knew, and I missed out, and life kind of passed me by. And I was angry, and I was resentful, you know? My mother had to get me a date through this friend of ours for it, so I would have a date for the senior prom, you know? And I couldn't dance, and I didn't know how to say, hey, somebody teach me, you know, so I had to do that. And then I can remember in my senior year in high school, I decided, the guy said, well, come on, we're going to get a date. Hey, why don't you get a date, and we'll go out after the game. Okay, well, I was in the band, so I asked this gal that was in the band if she wanted to go out after the game. And she said, sure, you know, and I said, okay, all right. So anyhow, it was fine, you know. After the game, we went back to the high school, put our instruments in the band room, you know, and I had my license then, and we jumped in a car, she and I in the front seat, and a buddy of mine, this other gal in the back. And now I'm sitting there, and now my head says, okay, now what do we do? You know, what are you going to do now? So our friend said, well, let's go to this place, we'll go have a milkshake and a burger. So we drove to this place, we had a milkshake and a burger, and it was fine, you know. And then we get back in the car, and he says, oh, there's a party over there, so let's go to this party. So we drive over to this party, you know. And we go to this party, and this gal's looking at me, and there's people there, and they're dancing, and I don't know how to dance, and I don't know how to say I don't know how to dance, so I'm standing against the wall trying to look cool, full of fear, you know, not able to say, hey, I don't know how to do this, would you show me? I really would like to learn how, you know. I couldn't do that. So I stood there full of fear, full of resentment, you know, and really frustrated. And then the next thing was, you know, it's time to go. So we get in the car. Now where do we go? Now it's showdown time, right? I'm riding around town, and this guy's in the back seat making out with this girl, see? And I don't know, you know, and I know that's what you're supposed to do, and I know that's what I want to do, but I had so much fear. I go, well, God, if we park over here, the cops are going to come along. And I got, you know, I didn't know here, didn't know where to go, didn't know what to do. I got so frustrated, I drove everybody home. See? See, and one more time, I knew it was me. I was the problem. And if I didn't know it for sure on next Monday morning at school, it was driven home to me for sure. Because the last person I wanted to see that Monday morning was that gal, right? I'm walking down the hallway, and guess who's standing there? Right? Her and a girlfriend, and walk by, good morning, I walk right by, I get about 3 steps beyond them, and I hear from back over my shoulder, there goes that cold fish. See, I knew it was me. It just reinforced it, you know. And here I was uncomfortable. I got out of high school, just got enough to get out of high school, I had enough grades to get into the college, which happened to be in my own hometown, and I was doing great. When I talked earlier about having these great plans, I did. See, I was going to be a doctor, right? Well, so I had enough grades to get into the local university, and I signed up for all these pre-med courses, and, you know, and I had calculus and scientific German and biology and anatomy and English and all these other courses, and after a semester and a quarter, I had about a D-minus average, because, see, me, study? No, no, no. The dean called me in and he said, young man, do you have a problem? And I said, no. He said, well, if you have an emotional problem, we have psychologists, you know, we have religious men here. Do you have any sort of problems? And I said, no, I don't have any problems. He said, good, then you make this grade point or you're out of here. And, you know, and he got my attention. And guess who made just that grade point average? You know, that's the way it was for me. You know, and I managed to graduate from college. A month before I graduated, my dad passed away. And I don't know whether it's coincidence or whether anything to do with it, but that was when my drinking career began. That's when I hooked up with alcohol. Because in a period of a couple of months, my dad died. I had to go to work to a new job that I knew I couldn't do. Don't ask me how I knew that, but I knew that. It was the time of the Berlin crisis when all of my buddies and I had already had our physicals. We were all 1A and they were beginning the draft, you know. And I didn't want to go into the service, you know. And yet I felt also that I felt that I'm responsible for taking care of my mother and my young brother. And the army was closing in. I didn't know what to do. And this professor friend of mine said, well, Bruce, if you're willing to go to Seattle, we can get you a job out at Boeing Aircraft and you can get what's called an occupational deferment. That means if you work for them, you won't have to go into the army. I said, sign me up, you know. So here I went. I jumped on an airplane for Seattle from New Jersey. The furthest west I'd ever been was Cleveland for a week or two when I was about 4 years old, you know. My other adventures out on my own were to a Boy Scout camp where I was so full of fear I got sick and they had them bring me home. I was counselor 1 year at a local camp up in New York State, and I was miserable all of the time. So that's really the only exposures I had been from being away from home or growing up or, you know, and I knew it was going to be better in Seattle, you know, until I got off of the airplane in Seattle, right? Here I am in a strange place. It rains all the time. I've got a job I know I'm not going to be able to do, no friends, and that's where alcohol and I began our relationship. At my 21 years of age, you know. And I knew that as soon as I got there, that I couldn't do the job, hooked up with drinking. Drinking became the only thing I knew how to do, because you see what happened when I talked about all those feelings I had, while I was loaded, I didn't have to deal with that discomfort all the time. You know, I never really had a lot of fun with it. I've heard people say, hey, drinking was wonderful, I had a lot of fun drinking. Drinking for me was, as I look back on it, was necessary, because that's the only time I had a little bit of comfort from this continual unrest, this continual fear, continual wanting to run. But you know, I'd wake up the next morning and I'd have to go to work and the fear would start all over again. And then a bunch of people began leaving to come to Southern California. The Apollo program was just starting then. And I knew that if I could get a job in Los Angeles and the Apollo program, it would be okay. So I begged the guys that were leaving, you know, if you get work down there, please call me. I really want a job. A couple months later, they called me, you know, and I blamed it all on the rain in Seattle. I said, you know, it's got to be the rain. It rained all the time there, you know. But if you need an excuse or want to drink some more, go to Seattle. It rains a lot up there, and you can blame it on the rain like I did. But I knew when I got down here in the land of sunshine, it was going to be wonderful, because I got a better paying job, and down here I came and got an apartment. And it wasn't a day or two, and I knew it wasn't any different. You know, now I had a job with more responsibility and more pay that I wasn't going to be able to do that job. Now, don't ask me how I knew that. Nobody ever said, Bruce, you're doing a lousy job. But I knew I couldn't do it, you know. And I had that fear. I would get up late in the morning. I would go to work late, you know. And then what I would do is my feeling about it was that at any moment, it's going to be all over. They're going to come to me and tap me on the shoulder and say, we found you out. Out. That's how I felt, because I knew I didn't know what I was doing. I knew I didn't know how to do it, you know. We were writing proposals for the Mars flyby mission. Man, I had no idea what the hell the Mars flyby mission was, And the people around me said, don't worry about it. Just write some stuff, take some stuff from here and from there, and you write it, and then we send it in, and we get funding for it. And I just knew I couldn't do that. But I stayed there for a while. And then I got involved with a gal, and I had been engaged to another gal, and the whole thing fell apart. And one night, I just kind of freaked out. And I got in my car, and I was going to go somewhere because I wanted to run because that's how I operated, and I didn't know where to go. So all I did all night long was drive around on all over the freeways of Los Angeles all night trying to figure out what to do, where to go. I knew I had nowhere else to go, no one else to turn to, you know. And the fear was great, and all I wanted to do was run and had nowhere to go. And I ended up back at work that next morning, and I just kind of broke down and started sobbing. You know, and it was one of those feelings of, somebody please help me. Somebody please figure out what is going on, you know. And what happened then is they said that, Bruce, we don't know what to do for you, but we have this doctor that knows a psychiatrist. Would you be willing to talk to him? Well, the next thing I know, they said, Bruce, would you be willing to go into a hospital? And they put me in a little hospital over here on Olympic and Barrington called Westwood Hospital, where, ironically enough, I have a panel there today. But anyhow, I went there as a patient, and I walked in there, checked that place out, and I absolutely loved it. For the first time since I could remember, I felt safe. It was comfortable. I didn't have to make decisions. I didn't have to deal with the boss, the job, the bank, people in the world, relationships, anything. They told us when to get up, when to go to sleep, what to eat, what we were going to do all day. And I loved it. And I would probably still be there today if insurance money hadn't run out. You know? And I had to go back to reality. Back to that world that I knew I didn't know how to deal with. And, you know, while in the hospital, they introduced me to the wonderful world of Thorazine. Now, that was the drug that day. You know, you could get it either in liquid form, tablet form, shot in the arm, shot in the ass, whatever you needed. And it was, you kind of, you know, slosh around and shuffle around the hospital. And I can remember, we used to play volleyball, and I can remember, you know, I wish today I had a videotape of me with the patients playing volleyball, right? I used to get angry and PO'd at these people because they wouldn't hit the ball right because they were too loaded. You know, they couldn't get to the ball. And I would love to see what I look like. No, on second foot, I'd rather not see what I look like. But that's the way it was. And when I left there, they gave me Thorazine and Stelazine and all those other wonderful things. But alcohol was it for me. I always got back to alcohol until later on when I discovered Valium. But it didn't fix it. The job didn't fix it, so I figured, well, I'll get married, that'll fix it. You know, so I picked the perfect candidate. I picked a woman who said, I never want to get married, right? And I don't know about anybody else in this room can identify with that kind of thing, but when you tell me no, I want it more, right? You tell me I can have it, maybe I don't want it, or maybe I didn't want it that bad, but tell me no, man, I'm going to go for it. And, you know, and that's pretty much it. You know, even later on, if I told Lynn, if she would have stopped immediately I began to pursue her, I probably would have lost interest. But she kind of, you know, said, no, not yet, not yet, and that kind of thing. And I kept going and going and going. But so that's kind of how that was. So I got married. We got married, and it was nice. God, I would come home from work, and she'd have a little champagne cocktail ready for me. And it was okay for a couple of weeks, you know. And then those old feelings set in. Now, not only do I not know how to deal with everything else that I couldn't deal with, now how do I deal with someone else in my life? You know, I didn't know how to do it. She didn't know how to do it. So for the next 8 and some years, we took turns going to the psychiatrist. She would go for a while, I would go for a while. She would go for a while, I would go for a while. You know? And that's where we were introduced to the wonderful world of Valium. You know? And we would go there and come home. And our life was totally insane, but not from the outside. From the inside, we would come home, I would sit down, we would pour a drink, you know, I would drink till I passed out, you know, we would sit down and she would bitch about her day, I'd bitch about my day. The next thing I know, I'm either on the floor or in the chair, the TV's gone, it's in the middle of the night, you know, or every once in a while she'd be pounding on me to wake up, you know, and it was, you know, that's kind of the way it was. And you know, and I can remember, for those of you who are feeling stuffers, you can probably identify with me, because I always had to look good in our marriage. I always looked like I was in control, you know. No matter what happened, it was okay, right? I can remember her getting so angry at me that she would pound on my chest with her fist saying, "Why don't you ever lose your temper?" Or she would blow up at me and have this big scene about it, And she'd be totally right, and I would play this silent martyr role to where before the evening was over, she would end up apologizing for me for losing her temper, and then we would kiss and make up, And then I would take all of those feelings and push them down and cover them up with alcohol. That's the kind of feeling person I was. So like I said, we took turns going back and forth between the psychiatrists, And the job wasn't, this job wasn't good, so I changed job and I got another job. And that's our pattern was. And she was taking a lot of Valium and I began having a lot of blackouts. And yet, if you looked at me before my world began to fall apart, you could see that from the outside, hey, this guy's got it together. My wife was chairman of a local English department. I had a job in Century City. Every job I got, this job I was managing some 20 people. I had an office overlooking the courtyard in Century City. Large staff, wore three-piece suits to work. We had to live in a nice house. We had two nice cars. And yet, funny things began to happen. See, my fear got so great that I got to the place where I couldn't make decisions. And that was the beginning of the end for me. Because the company was paying me a lot of money to manage these people, and that involved making decisions. And I couldn't make decisions. I would always slough it off or ask one of my associates, And eventually it caught up with me, and the boss called me and said, "Bruce, we pay you to make decisions. Don't be afraid to make decisions." See, I was so full of fear, I couldn't make the decisions because I was so afraid of making the wrong ones. He said, "Even if you make wrong decisions, just make them. We'll back you. Don't worry about it." And I couldn't do it, It got so bad that my wife left before I did in the morning. So what she would do is she would take my clothes and put them outside and hang them on the closet door, the right jacket with the right pants, with the right shoes, with the right tie. Because she knew that if she didn't do that, there was a strong probability that when she got home from school that night, I'd still be standing in front of the closet trying to figure out what to put on, and so totally full of fear that I might put the wrong thing on, and what would people say, that I might be still standing there paralyzed with fear, And even the Valium didn't do it. I used to carry the blue ones around loose, not even in the vial, in my pocket, And one of my employees would say, "Well, gee, Bruce, I'm having a problem with this project. Can you help me?" And I'd reach into my pocket and say, "Here, have some of these, And I didn't see anything wrong with that. I figured, "You've got a problem. This will help you. That's what I do for my problem, And when I started at this job, I had so much fear initially that I wouldn't go to lunch. But as the drinking progressed, I went from not going to lunch to going to lunch to four martinis for lunch, And Valium in the morning, for some reason I didn't discover while I still had this job that you could drink in the morning. The way I would start my day to get the shakes and the dry heaves, I would start popping Valium to get myself calmed down enough to where I could dress and get out the door and go to work. But what would happen is, after coming back from this great lunch, I'd be flying high, but about 4 or 4:30 or 5 in the afternoon, the alcohol would start wearing off. See, now, I never discovered speed or any uppers, so I was, I was at a big handicap here. The only thing I had going for me was Valium. So what would end up with happening, I'd be having a meeting in my office, and I would get real tired. So I would go over to the door and close the door and say, "Everybody, okay, well, let's go on with the meeting," and I would lay down on the floor and tell him, "Hey, I'm tired," and we would be in my office, I'm conducting this meeting, I'm lying down on the carpet on the floor. And that's the way it was, and I began having more and more blackouts. And I remember one year, my wife and I, on Mother's Day, we drove from West L.A. down to her parents' house down in Redondo Beach. And we got there and gave her mother her Mother's Day gift, and we sat down to play some cards. I remember pouring everybody a drink. My head shut off. The next thing I remember, my head turned back on again. I'm sitting up in bed back at home in West L.A. I have no recollection to this day of that day. The light was on, it was nighttime outside, and my wife wasn't in bed next to me. And I called to her, and she didn't answer. And I looked over, and I saw the bathroom door was closed, but the light was on, and I called her again, and she still didn't answer. I went over to the bathroom door in my stupor and tried to open it. It wasn't locked, but it was kind of wedged. So I eventually kind of wedged the door open and got it open far enough to get inside the bathroom, and here she was on the bathroom floor, and she was dead. And instinctively, I reached over to the drawer, And in the drawer, I had a vial of Tylenols, which the doctor had given me because I was having trouble sleeping. And there were like two or three left of the 50 that I had filled the day before. And I need to share that with you because I need to remember how it was for me and where alcohol took me. I can remember the first thing that I did. I went to the phone and called that psychiatrist and blamed him because this had happened. How could he let this happen to her? I called the paramedics, I called her, went downstairs and I had to get a cup of wine. I was drinking Mountain Red by this time because that's the only way I knew how to deal with my feelings. And our second speaker talked again about being numb at a funeral. Well, boy, I mean to tell you, that's the only way I could get through that thing. I was numb the whole way. And thank God a friend of mine came because he was able to keep me from getting totally blitzed out the whole time. Because that's the only way I knew how to deal with the feelings. The only way was to stay numb, and that's where I had gotten to. And the funny thing, in going through that whole period, I had this feeling inside of me intellectually as though I was outside of my body looking down on what was going on and knowing that my feelings weren't right for what was going on around me. And yet I didn't know why and I didn't know what to do about it. And for the next 2.5 months, I had drunk myself out of a job. I'd gone on a few job interviews drunk. I just remember coming to at various places. I can remember two brief instances of saying to somebody, yeah, well, maybe I do have a problem with alcohol. Gave all the booze away. 2 hours later, went to the store and bought more. You know, that kind of thing, that's all I remember. I remember also vaguely that my mother called and said, Bruce, your uncle is coming to California. And before you say you don't want to see him, I'm not even going to ask you to see him because I know you don't like him, but at least call him while he's out there and say hi to him as a favor to me. And for some reason, the set of miracles that were about to begin, because I said, no, I want him to stay with me. Not only where those words came from, I didn't really particularly care for the man, but those words came out of my mouth. And I picked him up at the airport, and I had been drinking, obviously, which is all I did. We came home that night, and the next morning I had to go to the attorneys to handle the paperwork associated with my wife's death. And by the time we got there, I was loaded again, and he had to help me and make all the decisions. And he watched me for a little while longer. And on our way home, we stopped at the liquor store. I knew I was out. I needed another quart of vodka, which I was drinking Lucky Vodka at that time. And I could drink anything I wanted to, but I was drinking Lucky Vodka. And went back to the house, which I was in the process of drinking away. I was still there, but I was on my way. And he said to me, Bruce, he said, I don't care what you do or what you say. Your problem is in that glass in front of you. It's about time you did something about it. And then the next miracle in my life happened because for some reason, I didn't go into a rage. I didn't get angry. I believe a little bit of willingness happened because I became willing to sit there and listen as he told me about some friends of his back in the post office in New Jersey that had joined Alcoholics Anonymous and that I might want to check it out. And see, I too only knew how to deal with psychiatrists. So I called the psychiatrist and said, can we come and see you? So we went to see the psychiatrist and I talked with him for a while, and after talking, he said, Bruce, you know, if you be alcoholic, and you might be based on what you've told me, because see, I believe that I went to him that I was honest. Because he said, do you drink a lot? And I said, no. See, I figured that what I drank, everybody drank. You know, I just figured everybody drank until they passed out every night. I didn't know any other way. You know, but I wasn't an alcoholic because I didn't yell and scream and throw things like my father did. See? So we talked for a while. He said, if you're the alcoholic, he said, the medical profession can't help you. You know, as I think about that, what a miracle that was for him to be able to say that. He said, if you have a chance of making it in this world, it's not a very good one, but if you have a chance, it's with Alcoholics Anonymous. I suggest you call them. And the next day, I called Alcoholics. I went home that day and called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the next day, I went to my first meeting. And it seemed to me in that blow that I was in, this guy came and picked me up. It seemed like he preached to me all the way over in the car. You know, we were at this meeting, it was in this dark room, and, you know, people said the Lord's Prayer, and they stuck this book in my hand, and he preached to me all the way home. You know, and then we got to my house, he said to me, Bruce, he said, I'm not going to meeting tomorrow. Here's a meeting director, here's some meetings in the area, I suggest you go. And I went, my attitude was, well, I'll never go to another meeting. Doesn't he know who I am? You know, he wants me to go on my own. I knew I would never go to another meeting. And then I think because my uncle was there and I was afraid of him hassling me, I decided I'd go to one more meeting. And I went to my next meeting. And at that meeting, I met two gentlemen who saw me walking in across the parking lot and saw how sick and how bloated and how frightened I was. And they said, Bruce, welcome. Come on in. And they took me inside and got me a cup of coffee and sat me down. And that evening began to unfold the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those events were about to change my life so significantly, and yet I had no idea about it, see. See, I was so full of fear when I got to, sick and full of fear when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful that I was, because, see, I knew I had nowhere else left to go. And my biggest fear was that if I didn't do everything to please you, that you wouldn't let me stay. And I knew I had nowhere else left to go. So I'm grateful that I didn't know any better, because I did a lot of things out of fear that you wouldn't let me stay, that you wouldn't approve, that you wouldn't want to keep me around. You know? Because that night we went to coffee, and this gentleman, you know, I had heard something about a sponsor at that meeting, and I said, what's a sponsor? And he told me, and I just blurted out, because I wanted everyone's approval, and I wanted to do the right thing so badly, will you be my sponsor? You know? And that was something I wish I could have taken back at the time, because I was come to regret that for the next year. Because he would say to me, pick me up at this time tomorrow night, we're going to this meeting. You know, we'd go to the meeting, and we'd get there early. The doors weren't even open yet, and we're there. You know, he said, now go set the chairs up, you know. And I'm going in, I was bloated and sweating. I'm setting the chairs up, you know, I'm working my ass off. He's over there with the gals BSing and shooting the shit, right? And I'm sweating my, and I'm watching him, and I'm resentful, you know. I'm not going to do this again, you know. And then the meeting would be over, and he'd say, okay, now you go wash the cups. And I said, okay. Well, he would say, no, we're going to wash the cups. But what he meant was, Bruce, you're going to go wash the cups. So I'm washing the cups, or taking the chairs down, and they're all over there laughing and having a good time. And I'm resentful because he's not doing what I'm doing. But I so wanted his approval, and I so wanted to say that I did it, you know. And then we get all done and say, okay, we're going to coffee at Junior's. And, you know, and I would go to coffee not wanting to be there and be resentful, you know, and people would just shooting shit, you know, and I wanted to be a part of, and, you know, and I was judging them, resentful, but I went. You know, I judged and resentful. My motives were lousy, but you know what? I did everything they asked me to do, you know, not willingly. So, that, you know, if you're not happy with your motives around here, I'm here to tell you it doesn't matter. Do it anyhow, you know. I didn't listen up here. I did what I was told and what was suggested to me, and I did those sorts of things, you know. And I got through the steps. I had a sponsor. I got through the steps, and I wrote an inventory. You know, and you all gave me this God of my understanding. And armed with that, I was able to do an inventory and make my amends and get through the steps, you know. And for the promises began to come true. And the program, the reason I'm speeding that up is the green light went on 5 minutes before I thought it was going to. So excuse me if I pick the pace up a little bit. But, so I did all those things. And yet here I was going to meetings, you know. And I finally got to the place where, you know, I want something more in my life than just going to meetings, you know. So I was able to start my own business in sobriety. Not without a lot of fearing, a lot of praying, but I was able to do that, you know. And I would also be able to begin dating in this program, you know, because I didn't know how to do that. I finally became willing to say, I don't know how to do this, you know. And with the help of Milton, who came into my life a year after I was sober, I began to learn how the secret of this thing is to say, I don't know. I'm uncomfortable. If I went on a date with somebody, I was frightened. I was able to say, I'm uncomfortable. You know? And little by little, I'd even be able to came willing and able to share my feelings with someone else, especially the opposite sex. To be able to say, hey, I'm uncomfortable. Can I talk with you about my discomfort so this wall isn't up between us? And I was able to learn how to do that. I went on a lot of dates. And a lot of dates, I met a lot of friends. I had this fear about going out on dates because, see, to me, a date meant, if I asked a woman to go out on a date, now, this was Tuesday, we were going to get together on Saturday, my head immediately went to what was going to happen Saturday night when we go home, right? See, that's where the fear was. So I had to play a little game and treat it as that all I was going to do was go and ask somebody and maybe I'll make a friend. Another friend that I hadn't had before. So I began to approach the dating thing from a friendship basis, you know? And what a difference it made for me, you know? But so I've learned some survival techniques, and I've learned some things that put me in good stead, you know? And I went out on a lot of dates, and nothing happened with the end of them. But you know what happened? I learned that it's okay to be me, It's okay to say, I don't know. It's okay to say, I'm frightened. I don't have to be macho anymore and pretend that I had all the answers. But see, nothing wasn't happening. I was getting impatient. I said, well, geez, I want to get married. I want to settle down, you know. I'm sober 4 years at that time. And I was making myself crazy. And I had a long talk with Milton one night, and finally I decided, he said, well, what's your primary purpose? And as I said earlier, my primary purpose is to carry the message. So I made peace, and I got down on my knees one night with God, and I said, God, I want to stay sober more than anything else. And if all I'm going to do for you, the way I can serve you best, is to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, then that's what I want to do. And I surrendered that. A week later, God put a lady into my life. I wish that I could tell you, I had the 1 minute light was on, so I only have 1 minute, to tell you that I met a lady, and we dated, we were married. We tried to have a child. I'm just going to tell you a few things to let you know you can get through anything in sobriety. We tried to have a child, and we couldn't. We went through all the infertility and all the other things that one could go through. And one day a woman came to us and said, we know a woman that's going to have a baby. Are you interested in having that baby? And we said yes. And we walked through the fear, and we went and met her. And we told her that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if she still wanted us, that we would be happy to take the child. And she selected us. And we went through the pregnancy with her, and we got the child. And we had that baby for 13 days, and I was at work one day, and Lynn called me hysterical, saying that woman called, and we have to give that child back. And I had to drive all the way back home, and by the time I got there, my sponsor was there, and her sponsor had talked to us. And we had to give that baby back that night, and the pain was absolutely incredible. And I learned one thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, that with the people in this fellowship, you can walk through anything. And I also learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you have to share the pain, and that's why we need to share with one another, because the pain is too much for any one of us to handle. And with your help and with your love and with God's help, we walked through that. And 3 months later, we went back to another attorney, and we came across another woman, and we flew to Portland and brought a little baby back with us. And that little guy is still with us today. And back in October, we were down at the courthouse, and the judge signed the papers, and that little guy is ours, and he is the joy of my life. And so if you don't think you can go through anything in Alcoholics Anonymous with the people here, you ain't seen nothing yet. And if you're new to this fellowship, there isn't anything that you can't go through sober. So keep that in mind, and you keep coming back and keep doing all those things that you swore you'll never do, because your head says no. Just do the opposite. The love in here will carry you through everything. And you'll come to know, I hope as I do, that the only reason any of us are here is because we have God's work to do, to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to all the corners wherever we go. We are the blessed ones. I'm blessed for being here tonight. I thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. It's an honor, a privilege. Susie, thank you for asking me. It's good to see you all here, and keep coming back. Thank you.